food, glorious food. Food is one of the themes that is being explored in the 69th Annual Conference on World Affairs, which begins today on the CU Boulder campus. As is tradition, KGNU is collaborating with the conference, bringing you several panel discussions live on air, and we'll be rebroadcasting some as well. This morning, we are breaking a little bit, though, with tradition. We have in past years gone over the pick for the Cinema Interruptus movie. But this year, we're going to take a look at a brand new feature of the Conference on World Affairs. They have identified three different themes that they will be exploring through the conference. And one of them is food. Why food matters, a taste of things to come. One of the new elements of this year's conference. Joining me, I have two guests who will be participating in various other panels during the week. Piper Davis is the co-owner of the Grand Central Bakery. She's also board chair of the Chef's Collaborative. Grand Central Bakery is in Seattle, but we're delighted to have you in Boulder. Thank you for coming in, Piper.
It's great to be here.
Well, closer to home, we have Sylvia Tawes, who is the owner of the Fresh Ideas Group, and she's also the co-owner of Pastures of Plenty, which is an organic farm in Boulder, which offers flowers, but also vegetables and CSA shares. She joins us as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, it's good to have you both. As I said, this is a rather new element of the conference. Sylvia, do you want to talk a little bit about what it's all about and how food is going to be explored as a theme?
I love that food is Interruptus this year. I was lucky enough to be on a small task force that was set with the charge to create a food track. And I think it's telling that in 69 years, this is the first time that there's a focus on food. Certainly Boulder as a hub, but also with what's going on globally with a lot of fractures in our food system. I think it's high time, and I'm deliriously happy by the kind of experts and important change agents that we have coming to town for CWA just for this track.
We're going to talk about some of those, one of them being Piper Davis. But yeah. I mean, Boulder is such a mecca of food and local food and consciousness around food. So it does seem like it's been a long time coming to get to a designated food track.
Right. I mean, we eat every day. We may not drive a Tesla or electric car, but there's been a technology track for so many years. There's been a lot of focus on space. I think this is part of the evolution is finally we're not taking food for granted as a society, and we are looking at it as an issue. So food politics, food issues, I think all of those are going to be, pardon the pun, on the table during CWA.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned politics, because the politicization of food, or maybe a growing consciousness around how food is a political choice, is something that I know is going to be reflected. And we as consumers, of course, make decisions every single day about not just what we eat, but where we buy that food from and who we buy it from. And you as a local farmer are very much aware of that connection between the consumer and the producer.
Yeah, I think Piper and I, who share a extremely intense joy of what we call procurement and provisioning, basically everybody, every citizen is an eater, and therefore every citizen can vote with their dollars. So I think when people, whether they're pushing their cart through the supermarket or they're able to go to the farmer's market, you know, making that conscious choice, not just about what they buy, but how much they buy, how they're going to use it, how they're not going to waste it. Those are all really timely topics today.
And of course, who they buy it from.
Yeah.
Now, we are very lucky locally to be in really a food basket. And so many people have a direct relationship with the food producer through farmer's markets or through CSAs. But for a lot of people who don't, there are a lot of other people involved in that food chain. And so this maybe goes into what you talked about, the provision and the procurement.
P&P. Piper can speak to that. She's actually from that other little food hub out west called Portland. And, you know, I think we need to get out of the bubble of Boulder. That's why we have a conference on world affairs. We need to think about 1 in 5 children are still going to bed hungry, including right here in Colorado. But nationally, that's our shameful statistic. So how we get healthy food, not just to fine dining establishments, but to kids every day. How children in places like Pine Ridge, just 5 hours from here, poorest community in America, how children can leave school on Friday with a backpack respectfully filled with nourishing, natural, and organic food that the whole family can enjoy. You know, these are issues that need to be discussed. We can't be ostriches anymore.
Well, as I said, Piper Davis, you're a partner, you're a co-owner of the Grand Central Bakery. I said it's in Seattle, also in Portland.
Yes.
The Pacific Northwest is covered there. But you were also the chair of the board of the Chefs Collaborative. Now, that's a national nonprofit. There are thousands of chefs and food mm-hmm. professionals involved in that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the Collaborative is a unique organization nationally. What we do is we educate, inspire, and then celebrate chefs and food professionals who are trying to build a better food system. And there's both the economic reality of that. So the more chefs purchase well-raised food, we can get into the linguistics of, it's very complicated how we judge our food. And I think if we want to talk about that, that's a big conversation. But I like to think about, there are general ways that we know that food, that good food and better food is produced. And the more chefs and the more food professionals buy it, it provides an actual economic incentive to do things. And then the second part, which is a little more nuanced, but I think more powerful in certain ways, is that in addition to having this actual economic body that makes a difference in the economy, we're setting an example for the rest of the culinary community. When we have Rick Bayless is coming to town this week, for example, when a chef of a national profile like that gets up and talks about what kind of food he is purchasing for his restaurants and why, the sorts of people that he's supporting, how he chooses to treat his employees, that makes everybody else sit up and go, oh, well, if Rick Bayless is doing that, maybe I better do it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the impact, the influence that chefs have in terms of both their kind of bully pulpit, if you're a celebrity chef, but also every chef, everybody who cooks food for other people, their customers are coming in, sitting down and eating in their establishments every day. And through that exposure to ideas and food can be both a celebration and an education.
Yeah. So you're the co-owner of a bakery
yes.
in Seattle and Portland.
Yes. So we have a Grand Central Bakery we're both wholesale and retail. So we have about half of our business is wholesale bread that we deliver to different restaurants and grocery stores.
Happy to report, bread is back.
Bread is back, exactly. And and then we have 10 cafes that are neighborhood cafes with an extended menu where we do serve soup, salad, sandwiches, along with fresh made pastries and bread. And through that is where I've kind of developed we started 20 years ago. Actually inspired by our Chef's Collaborative event to take tomatoes off of our sandwiches, except for when they're in season. That was the first step we took. And today we don't serve any, we buy all our meat locally. We don't serve anything that was ever raised in a CAFO or fed subtherapeutic antibiotics. We buy a huge percentage of our summer vegetables directly from farmers. So we buy all Northwest grown wheat. We only buy no-till wheat. We're experimenting with some perennial grains. So the scale has given us, instead of what my experience, both philosophically and then my business experience, shows me that as you when you take your values and you grow them, you actually are giving an opportunity to expand them. And we, like, not only is the food better at Grand Central than it was 20 years ago, but our impact on the local economy is much more profound, being a 10 unit. You know, we used to spend $500,000 a year on food, and now we spend $2.5 million on ingredients in a year. And so that has really inspired us to sort of practice this continual improvement. And I think it's one of the most important things about the good food movement is that we don't get hung up on these, when we're talking about all those lines, whether it's grass-fed, organic, pasture-raised, every terminology, I can poke a hole in any name you give me, really, if you want me to. But I also think that we can, that when people are inspired and they see that it's small changes, it's okay, how many like pasture-raised eggs, how many pasture-raised eggs can the food system give us, and how many can we purchase this year and afford it? And then how do we raise the price a little bit, and how do we educate our customers so they share that value? And then the next thing you know, you go from with what we did in the egg case is we charged 25 cents more for a breakfast sandwich. So instead of $4.50, it went to $4.75.
Did you notice a difference in the volume of people buying those sandwiches.
No, no, not at all. And that 25 cents allows us to go from a $2 a dozen egg to a $5 a dozen egg. Because you're you've just added 25 cents to each individual egg. Therefore, that just takes care of it. And whenever people are like, oh, you know, we can't afford it. It's like you have to be clever, but you can't. Access is a big thing for me.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned there the economics of scale and really your, you know, example there about the eggs. That's a big part of it. Is that a barrier? Because when you have the economics of scale, you have maybe more farmers coming together. Maybe then you have a distributor. Maybe then you have another agent involved. And the more people then you have, does it get harder to wrangle all those folks in, and then for the consumer to have that direct relationship with the farmer?
It does. There are multiple scales of production that are appropriate depending on where you are. And as you grow, yes, you find that you need one year it took like four farmers to get us our tomatoes in season. But then we started working with a single farmer who plants for us, knows we pay our bills on time, was able to plan and everything else. And so we were able to help grow this smaller farm's tomato business by being their sole customer.
I think you're going to see this on the program for the food track at CWA, this idea of scaling the good. So not thinking about things in a provincial, small, tiny farm way, but how can you help that small farmer through that kind of conscious capitalism, if you will? How can you help that small farmer become a medium size to large farmer? I just wanted to say that all of these are free to the public, as is the CWA tradition. Being able to have not just Chef Rick Bayless, but his amazing, super smart wife, Deanne Bayless, who's co-owner with him in all of his restaurants, is kind of a real coup. Deanne has been on Women Chefs and Restaurateurs Board. She is kind of the business real management mind, so that allows Chef Bayless to be able to be the true creative. They're an amazing duo together. She's usually happily behind the curtain. So I think showing that there are these women leaders really pushing the envelope in more conscious procurement practices, but also today, back of the house, how is that dishwasher getting paid?
And
right?
I actually want to talk a lot about that, because I think that's a conversation
farmers.
That doesn't always happen.
It's farm workers.
I want to remind our listeners that this is KGNU, and it's a panel discussion that's part of the Conference on World Affairs that begins today on the CU Boulder campus. It goes all week. We're linking to the website at kgnu.org. And today we're hearing from Sylvia Tawes, who is a local farmer herself. She and her husband own Pastures of Plenty in organic farm in Boulder, and they have CSA shares and vegetables. But she's also the owner of the Fresh Ideas Group, and that's a communications agency that really focuses on natural and health food solutions. Also joining us, Piper Davis, who is a partner in the Grand Central Bakery that's in Seattle and Portland, and that's a chain of cafes and bakeries. But she's also the board chair of Chefs Collaborative, which is a nationwide network of more than 12,000 chefs and food professionals, and they're all dedicated to sustainable food becoming second nature. Now, we're focusing on food this morning because this is a new element of the conference. Why Food Matters, A Taste of Things to Come, is one of the three themes that's really been identified by the conference. As we've heard, we're going to have some big chef names. Rick Bayless is going to be here as well as his wife. Who are some of the other folks, not so much chefs, but maybe other people involved in the food chain that will get us thinking
Thank
about
you.
Food?
One of our other keynotes is Deborah Eschmeyer, and she's the former CEO for our wonderful former First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign. And so she's really going to speak to a lot of issues around, you know, food insecurity for children. What do we do to provide better food to more people? How can the good food movement not just be in the Boulders and Berkeleys of the world and Portlands, but how can it move to those areas most in need? We've also got that great intersect where business, technology, and food totally mash up into a wonderful, more conscious, delicious sandwich. And that's Michael Baca, and he's the CEO for Google Food. I understand that he is personally responsible every day, don't know how he sleeps, for 135,000 meals being served at Google campuses around the world. We're very fortunate to also have Richard McCarthy, who is the executive director for Slow Food USA. And so you've got this kind of wonderful, tribe of people who've not just recently joined the good food movement, but they've really been pioneers. And Rick Bayless was actually one of the original founders of Chefs Collaborative. So I think there's this wonderful kind of pioneers who are now wanting to pass the baton on to the next generation of leaders. I do think we in Boulder, and perhaps in Portland, Piper, you can speak to this, are a little guilty of some chest pumping about what a food mecca we are. So you're going to see on a lot of the food track panels that it's not just about the wonderfulness of it all, what I call the over-preciousness of it all. It's actually issues like food insecurity, you know, moving vegetables to more center of the plate. How does that happen? Not just in a culinary way, but in a real major societal shift. I think the idea of creating a better food system is one that is not new. And I just keep looking at these fractures and how do we fix them for the long term?
Well, in terms of that intersection of, mm-hmm. you know, social economic justice
yes.
and food, the food justice movement in many ways, Piper Davis, I mean, with your work in not just the bakeries in Seattle and Portland, but also through the Chefs Collaborative, there's that focus, of course, on good food, sustainable food. But in terms of the economics, we're hearing reports about food service workers, particularly maybe in fast food areas, having themselves to go to food banks because they're not earning enough to live.
Well, so you're skirting around a very hot issue in food service right now, which is the minimum wage. And it is a very complicated issue because what we've done is build a system on a combination of completely underpaid, from the underpaid farm workers to the service, to the inequity of front of the house and back of the house service models, and where the customer, food is the only business where the customer pays part of your wage as if you're a dentist, you're not waiting for your, you know, oh, do I like my teeth? I'm going to give an extra $50. Okay. So the tipping economy is very complicated. The minimum wage is subsidized by the tipping economy. And it's starting to make the movement towards, like, I believe personally, this is not that we have to move to $15 minimum wage. We've done it in Portland, we've done it in Seattle, and we have to do it. But it's going to change the way in order to deal with some of these equity issues, because you just cannot have people earning. I mean, the federal minimum wage is a joke. And the idea that someone is washing the dishes all day or even serving you at a quick service place and can't afford to eat the food that they're serving is ridiculous.
Well, the other area, of course, where politics and food service are integrating in many ways or intersecting, immigration.
Yeah.
Because I
yeah.
think nobody
Absolutely.
Is going to eat
no,
a piece
already,
of food or be served a meal that has not been
it's
somehow
been,
impacted by immigrants.
Yes, it's the impact of it actually started. I know we don't like to say anything bad about him, but it started during the Obama administration when the mm-hmm. things were good for immigrants during the. Here, I'm going to say something nice about Bush. is that we've noticed that there definitely is the lockdown of immigration is definitely affecting the applicant pool, my thing is to not. I believe that the robust food system that we want starts to bring in where we start to diversify some of these. Part of the reason that the food system is so vulnerable to something like immigration is because we have one answer to our farm labor mm-hmm. issue, which is Mexican farm workers. That's the single answer. And so by coming up with more diverse answers to that problem, I think we will both have a fairer and safer, we'll have a better production system, and we will have a more resilient food system.
Sylvie Toles, do you want to weigh in on that from a local perspective?
Yeah, I also want to be really transparent that I do not call myself a farmer because I actually just get to sleep with a real farmer, and that's my husband, Lyle Davis. I'm someone who helps with the newsletter. I help with our CSA. But I honor that both my husband and about 15 other employees during the season do the real work. And I just want to say this is our third season now, not just for our farm, but most of the farms that you'll see at Boulder County Farmers Market. This is our third season where we have a severe employee shortage. And there are not all kinds of woofers from colleges around the world knocking down at our door. And it's very, very, visceral, hard work and backbreaking work. And we've always paid way above minimum wage. But you cannot attract employees right now if you're not paying $15 or above, upwards of $20 an hour. And part of it is we're victims of our own success. So we've got cranes everywhere with construction. So there are construction jobs. So we're competing for those.
And it's also an expensive place to live.
Yeah, I do have this idea for an art project, and maybe we can actually plant this seed for next year's Conference on World Affairs. But I would love to see a wall built, but it's a wall of food. I would love to see a vertical wall of food that the whole community could actually harvest from. But this idea of putting up a wall, and that is going to, quote, A, solve our immigration, and B, not be anything but negative on our food economy, which means all of our society.
Well, we just have about 3 or 4 minutes
sure.
left, and we want to give a shout out to some of the panels that
yes.
are happening. But just in the last few minutes that we have, Piper Davis, I mean, it seems those issues around minimum wage, paying people a fair wage, people, you know, back of house and the food producers themselves. This goes back to the fact that we seem to be addicted to cheap food here, and that the amount of yeah. money that we allocate from our budgets in a household, for whether it's a conscious thing or whether it's because housing is now more expensive or we're paying more for healthcare, but we're paying less for
yep.
food.
No.
And that seems to be a real psychological thing.
Yeah, America, I think my understanding is that sort of World War II did that to us, where we learned how to massively produce more calories than we could consume as a country. And we started down the merry road of inexpensive food, which is great for a lot of things, except for the fact that it doesn't necessarily reward responsible practices across mm-hmm. the board. And
how do we get back to where we used to be?
I think it's complicated. I mean, I like to start with simple things like, how did this food leave the soil it was grown in? How can we just like start with the soil? Can we think about what the impact of what we eat has been on the soil? Or how was this food? How are the people treated who handled this food through the, just by mm-hmm. asking these basic questions? Okay. I think that you start to realize that, and it's a shift of your values, but it means that we're going to be driving fewer cars, living in smaller houses, eating more vegetables and less well-raised meat. And that's what's going to happen. It just has to.
And in terms of shifting values, yeah. it seems we need to prioritize quality over quantity.
Exactly.
When we look at the food waste that we have mm-hmm. and when we look at the quantities
yep.
that, you know, serving sizes, not just in restaurants, but when you go to the grocery store, that was one of the first
yeah.
things that just impacted
talking.
Me when I came to the U.S., how big everything is.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's like I've heard numbers from 40% to 60% of everything we grow, we throw away.
Yeah. And I would like to say that one of the answers to that question, how do we shift this, is through increased food literacy. And I think it starts in preschool. You know, it's let's bring back not home economics, but let's bring back cooking and engaging children at a very young age. Right here in Boulder County, every single student of Boulder Valley School District probably has visited a pumpkin patch 5 times, 6 times before they land in middle school. Never once have they cooked with a pumpkin. And we need to change that. I also think towards food literacy, we all have this amazing program Wednesday and Thursday for the Food Track series. And it opens up with such a beautiful message, why food matters, nourishing our bodies and the land. And that will be Rick Bayless as well as Deborah Eschmeyer. And I think if we thought about that every day, why food matters, then maybe that would increase the value. And rather than spending 13% of our household income on food, we might get up in that 20th percentile. That would make a huge difference.
Well, there's a lot of food for thought at this year's Conference on World Affairs. There was a track called Why Food Matters, A Taste of Things to Come. It's one of the new elements that's being introduced in this year's conference, food being one of the three themes that have been identified. And my guests today who have kicked off the conference, it's officially the first panel. It's always exciting to have KGNU. We've had Piper Davis, who's the co-owner of the Grand Central Bakeries there in Portland and Seattle. And she's also the board chair of Chefs Collaborative, a nationwide nonprofit of chefs and food professionals. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And also we've had Sylvia Taws, who is co-owner of Pastures of Plenty, a local farm in Boulder. And also she is the owner of Fresh Ideas Group, that is a communications agency that really specializes in health and natural food solutions. There's a lot of food themed events happening in the Conference on World Affairs. We're linking to the website. You can also pick up hard copies of the brochure throughout yeah. the Boulder
download the app. It's really, really, really easy.
Yeah. KGNU is also hosting several other conference panels tomorrow morning. We're going to have a science panel. One of the other themes is space. This year's conference, and tomorrow morning at 8:35 we'll host a discussion on new adventures in astronomy. We'll have all of our schedule at kgnu.org. In the meantime, Piper Davis and Sylvia Tawes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is 9 o'clock. You're listening to Community Radio KGNU, Boulder, Denver and Fort Collins. Up next, it's Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the saber rattling between the U.S. and North Korea seems to amp up daily, with Kim Jong-un shooting off missiles and Donald Trump his mouth, with vague threats to go after the country. Corporate media's cartoonish portrayal of North Korea doesn't help as we try to understand how things got to this pass and how we can get out of it. We'll hear from writer and activist Yun Lee from Zoom In Korea. Also on the show, April is Sexual Harassment Awareness and Prevention Month, with Fox News helpfully providing Exhibit A of why it's needed. April is also when we get to Equal Pay Day, when women's earnings catch up to men's from the year before. These issues are connected, but not often by the press. We'll talk with Jennifer Reich, legal director of Equal Rights Advocates. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. That the main economic story of the last 40 years is the massive upward redistribution of income is hard to deny. The top 1%'s share of national income has more than doubled over this period to over 20%. But as Dean Baker reminds on Fair.org, the rich, who have used their control over the levers of economic power to ensure that an ever larger share of the country's wealth goes into their pockets, don't want people to pay attention to that. So, quote, they endlessly push out nonsense stories to try to divert the public's attention from how they structured the rules to advance their interests. And since the rich own the newspapers, they can make sure that we hear those stories. Close quote. That makes for news articles like one the Boston Globe ran recently titled How the Baby Boomers Destroyed Everything. Writer Bruce Cannon Gibney, evidently with a straight face, blames the 77 million people born between 1946 and 1964 for, well, everything. But for one thing, improvidence, as reflected in low levels of savings and high levels of bankruptcy. Well, Baker checked on the link on the bankruptcy stat. The report stated, quote, expensive health care costs from a serious illness before a patient received Medicare and the inability to work during and after a serious illness are the prime contributors to financial crises among those 55 and older, close quote. Doesn't sound like moral failing. We must be missing something. The low savings complaint is bemusing in light of 10 years of complaint from policy types that people weren't spending enough to bring the economy back. Baby boomers, not ExxonMobil or the Koch brothers, are to blame for unaddressed climate change. And they stole from the young thanks to, quote, all those tax breaks, bailouts, easy money, deregulation, and the bubbles they spawned, close quote. And then they tolerated astounding debt expansion in order to keep the goodies flowing. So, yeah, the vast numbers of poor and middle-class people between 53 and 71 are as responsible as, say, Larry Summers for entrenched inequality. Well, articles like this might make you laugh, but the intent isn't funny, which is, as Baker writes, to, quote, tell folks to ignore all those incredibly rich people with vast amounts of money. The reason most people are not seeing rising living standards is the damn baby boomers who expect to get Social Security and Medicare just because they paid for it. Close quote.